may be familiar with it, a very large congregation. He began with a law degree and was an attorney and litigator for many years, then took smicha, and his first rabbinic position was in Kehillas Eitz Chaim in Kibar Hills, which means that the two of us are actually landslide, because I grew up in Kibar Hills. I remember when the shul was founded on the same block as Rabbi Lerner, Rabbi Roth, and now his son-in-law there. And from there, he moved about 25 years ago or so to Teaneck, where he's been ever since. He was a prominent member of the Beis Din for Gairus in New Jersey, and lately is also one of the senior fellows of the Coalition for Jewish Values, which is a new rabbinic organization, which I'm a member as well, that is attempting to publicize the position of Jews through the eyes of Judaism, of Torah Judaism, rather than the media and people in general knowing what are supposedly Jewish values are really espoused by people who have a different religious posture than we do. So, Brzezinski is doing important work in many fields, comes into contact in particular with members of the rabbinate and other denominations, and he is poised, well poised, to line up on this important topic.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, EDD, Rabbi Shulman. I want to thank as well Richard Levine, the president of the shul, and Alan Blumenthal once again was so kind to invite me back to this wonderful Kehilo, where I've had the opportunity to address everyone a number of times already over the last decade. I see I'm the last in the series. So if I drive people away, no one will ever know. It wasn't me. I want to thank as well Olga Baumel for sponsoring this evening in memory of Joseph Baumel. And welcome my mechatonim here, Balaam Buzzy Katz, natives of Flatbush. And welcome the people who came from B'nai Shurin tonight as well, from Teaneck, as if they haven't heard me enough. They came to Brooklyn also. So I want to start with a disclaimer. You know, I know a lot of Jews are uncomfortable with the term Orthodox because it was something that was pinned on us by the Reform in the middle of the 19th century. It's not something we chose. It means Orthodox, correct belief, but it's not enough to have correct belief. You have to also do the mitzvahs as well. So it's somewhat of a misnomer, but we use it for convenience sake, that it is what it is. And the truth is, there's some hubris involved in myself, anyone discussing the future of non-Orthodoxy. I'm not part of their world, so who am I to comment on their future? I can comment better on the future of Orthodoxy, but I have nothing to say about that. But what is the future of non-Orthodoxy? And I'll surprise you. The answer is that, of course, it will exist. It always has existed. It always will exist. The question is why, and what are the problems that they're having? Why should I be optimistic, if that's the right word, about their existence? In fact, if I started this discussion by saying they have no future at all, I think many people would agree, especially in light of the introduction that Rabbi Shulman gave. It makes sense. The fact is, the non-Orthodox world is in crisis today. And a crisis such they haven't experienced in many, many centuries. And there's no joy involved in saying this. I mean, a person's left foot is not happy if the right foot is injured, because you get to use it more. No, there's no joy at all. On the contrary, it's Klal Yisrael. These are our brothers and sisters, and we're losing them on a daily, on a weekly, on a monthly basis by the thousands. To cite the Sedra of the week, which I have to, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, in essence, what Yehuda did was demonstrate tremendous Mesiris Nefesh at the point of risking his own life his own Olam Haba, his own spiritual future, in order to keep Klal Yisrael whole, which what he was doing to save Binyamin. So that type of Mesiris Nefesh, that type of self-sacrifice, is one that should animate all of us to do whatever we can do to save our brethren. So we should be mourning the situation that's befallen us and not gloating over it, especially since I could tell you personally, there are many, many fine people who are being swept up by assimilation. They just don't know any better. So on the surface, their situation seems to be bleak and very dire, and the question is why? And I want to just briefly outline the crisis as it's befalling them and see how it got to that situation and see what can be rectified. One story is found in the Numbers, and there's a steep decline. Yes, surveys are surveys. They're not always accurate. For some reason, which really escapes me, as a child, I remember seeing surveys then, go back 50 years already, and the Orthodox were 10% of the population. And now the latest surveys come out, and the Orthodox are 10% of the population. How's that possible? We can't crack the 10% barrier? I mean, the Metzius is obviously different. Obviously, there's so many more Orthodox Jews than 10%. So you could finagle the numbers, I guess. You can count many halachic non-Jews as Jews. You could undercount Orthodox Jews who tend to be concentrated in certain areas. But there's no reasonable, plausible way that we remain 10% of the Jewish population. Can't be. Now, it's clear that most American Jews today are unaffiliated. It sounds shocking to hear, but the decline of the non-Orthodox movements has left American Jewry defined more by lack of affiliation. Yeah, there's still people who say, for lack of a better term, if they don't practice or learn or are uninvolved in the Jewish world, they're reformed by default. But they don't say that. More people today, 45 to 50%, identify themselves as unaffiliated. I remember I spoke in February to a group of Israeli rabbis in Israel, young rabbis, and all they knew was of this trichotomy of Orthodox, Reform, Conservative. Reform is the largest, and like this, and then there's Conservative, and then there's Orthodox. And I said, you should know, that's no longer the reality. The reality is most are unaffiliated. They've dropped out of the non-Orthodox world. Worse than that, estimates range from 30% to 50% of Reform Jews, of nominal Reform Jews today, are not halachic Jews. 30 to 50%. That's a substantial figure. The conservative movement is hemorrhaging. Even according to their numbers, they're now less than 20% of American Jewry, but the more telling figure is that they're approximately 10% of Jews under 30 identify as conservative. Meaning now they skew more elderly in the demographic. They did not reproduce, as the Reform did not. And as time goes on, their percentage will shrink even more. And we see this. Temples are merging or consolidating. Rabbi Shulman's comment about Baltimore, we've lived in Teaneck. Teaneck had a flagship conservative temple, existed for 40, 50 years. And when I moved to Teaneck, there are, I think, two or three conservative temples, one or two Reform temples, and now there's one Reform temple, one conservative temple, and the flagship conservative Jewish center is now Orthodox. When I came, there were six or seven Orthodox shuls. Now there are 16 or 17 Orthodox shuls, many spawned by me, but whatever. There are many more shuls. The population has grown. The Orthodox population has grown. That's not only true of Jewish centers like Teaneck, meaning centers of Jews, but it's true across the country. Since, if you think about it, the non-Orthodox are not constrained by not driving on Shabbos, It makes no sense to have 2-3 small temples in neighboring towns. They might as well consolidate when the numbers are no longer there to support it. Seminaries today, the rabbinical seminaries, are majority women. And this has been proven, it's been documented for another time, but female clergy drive men away from the temple. For whatever reason, it's a different discussion altogether, but the non-Orthodox temples are by and large female-dominated in terms of their attendance on Shabbos, which is small to begin with. Friday night still attracts people, especially in the winter. They start 7 o'clock. But Shabbos morning, you're talking in the dozens. Unless there's a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, then the whole family comes out. Now, so there's a numbers problem. A lot of that problem is caused by intermarriage. The chickens have come home to roost. Sad to say. Outside the Orthodox world, we always talk about this figure, but we never really analyze it. Over 70% of the marriages outside the Orthodox world are intermarriages. That means most marriages are intermarriage outside the Orthodox world. We hover around the 50% figure only by factoring in the Orthodox population in which intermarriage exists. It's negligible. It's about 1% or 2%. 70%. Think about what that means. Now it's in almost in the second generation. It means you're losing Jews by the thousands constantly. And worse than that, intermarriage is no longer frowned upon. It's not even an issue anymore to discuss. It's just the way it is. The Reform rabbinate performs intermarriages. The conservative rabbinate will soon perform intermarriages. They're riven by a dispute now, internal dispute. Rabbis are leaving the rabbinical assembly because the assembly still bars their members from performing intermarriages. But today, marriage is widely seen as a matter of love and conscience. You love someone, you marry that person. It doesn't matter who. Why should it matter? And it's considered immoral and racist to tell someone, you can't marry this person because they're not Jewish. That is today unacceptable. It's the language of the new generation in which is no longer even a pretense of a commitment to halacha. And now, of course, in the last year, conservative Judaism has begun accepting interfaith couples in their temples as members. It's one way to solve a membership crisis. We could do the same, by the way. Just invite non-Jews to become members. They're giving kibbutzim as well. I used to get every five, you know, open the Aron HaKodesh. I used to get every 5 years or so a question about someone attending an intermarriage. Usually it involved a colleague in the workplace. I get now at least once, twice, three times a year questions that sometimes involve colleagues, but more often involve family members, cousins, siblings, etc. Should they go or not go? I would get more, but people know I take a hard line on it. To me, intermarriage is a red line. I mean, you're going, you're celebrating a sin. You're celebrating the destruction of Klal Yisrael. Others say, well, it's Kiruv, you'll keep the person close, etc. So different opinions, but all I know is what the economists say, and that when you subsidize a product, you get more of it. When you tax a product, you get less of it. So when you indulge or embrace misbehavior, you're going to get more of it. So attendance, which dilutes our horror at intermarriage, attendance is going to encourage more of it, not less of it. How accepted is intermarriage today? Think about it. A number of you told me you listened to my series on the presidents and the Jews. If you just think about it, John Kennedy's daughter married a Jew. Bill Clinton's daughter married a Jew. Al Gore's daughter married a Jew. I think Joe Biden's daughter married a Jew. We make very attractive husbands, apparently. But the fact is, nobody batted an eye. No one said, how could it be? How could you do that? It's part of American life. Someone said earlier today in my shul that the problem today in America is not anti-Semitism. The problem is philo-Semitism. It's not that they hate us, they love us. That's the problem. They love us so much, they want to marry us. When it's no big deal, then it's the fulfillment of the melting pot. And the melting pot has never been good for Jews. A mosaic is better. But a melting pot, everything is mixed together like a challant, that doesn't work out well. It's like challant 5-6 days later. Well, there's a third issue also that obviously is tied to this, and that's assimilation. Assimilation is rampant. What's assimilation reduced to its core today? The many ways to be Jewish. Don't tell me how to be Jewish. There are many ways to be Jewish. So the values are drawn from the society, really from the New York Times. There's no Torah. There's no really Jewish idea. There's no reason to be Jewish. To be Jewish involves some measure of particularism. If the religion becomes just social justice with holidays, then why should I do anything? Why does it matter who I marry, or whether there's Shabbos or mitzvos or anything else? And I say again, I take no joy at all in saying this, because in fact, I'll say something controversial now. They have what to contribute. The truth is, the core of social justice is obviously drawn from the Torah, but they've made it its own value, and they've retained it as a value even when it diverges from the Torah. And that shouldn't be. But if we didn't have Reform or Conservative Judaism and their commitment to social justice, we would become too narrow, too parochial. We wouldn't be Or LaGoyim. We're supposed to be a light unto the nations. The thing is, their Or is not an Or. It's Kiner Mitzvah Torah Or. The Torah is the light, not values that come from elsewhere and not the Torah. Values that are fabricated. It's the values of Torah. So we have an Or. If they didn't exist, I don't think there'd be as much of an interest in the Jewish world, in our world, of talking, of publicizing the ideas and the values of Torah. Agav Urcha, Rabbi Shulman mentioned, that's one of the reasons why we started the Coalition for Jewish Values, because constantly we'd see in the media, Jews say this, Jews say that, Jews are Reform conservative, and nothing to do with Torah. And at the very least, you'd think something that purports to be Jewish should be rooted in the Torah, in the Talmud. Some pious Jew said it. No. The values are not drawn, but people assume that if a Jew speaks, what he's saying must be Jewish. But in fact, it's not so. And the degeneration over time is clear, and avera gereres avera, and you have to have a certain measure of sympathy. Because they did try. They tried in the wrong way, but they did try. So they had no mechitza, all right, in order to bring in families. But it didn't drive people to the temple. In fact, it drove them away from the temple. Permitting people to write on Shabbos literally drove them away from the temple. Because once you say you could drive or ride, you ride to the mall, ride to the beach. Well, why do you have to ride to a temple? They relaxed the conversion standards, but that didn't stop intermarriage. But it encouraged it, and it made conversion into a joke. So they made peace with intermarriage, it goes back 35 years already, and that engendered, in the Reform movement, the patrilineal descent ruling that you could trace Jewish status through the father or the mother, meaning one Jewish parent, when even conversion was too much to ask. Belief in God is now optional by their own admission. Very few Reform rabbis believe in God. Most conservative rabbis do not believe in Torah min HaShemayim, Torah Shebaal Peh. So it's a spiritual free-for-all. A spiritual free-for-all. If you can do whatever you want, it's very hard to sustain. And I feel bad for the average Jew who doesn't really know any better, who doesn't know that their clergy, in an attempt to be modern and sophisticated, has sold them a bill of goods. Ki azvu mayim chayim, mekor mayim chayim, es Hashem. They abandoned the source of the living water. And what did they get? What was sold to them? Well, a little over 100 years ago, when conservative Judaism began, it began as a classic compromise, which in retrospect, we can't support, but we can understand it. It was an American Judaism. It was traditional, it was a little old world, a little new world. For decades, they claimed to be halachic, and such was important to the founders, even if not to the laity, And by the third generation, not even to the leaders, but their business model was at least plausible. Jewish, but modern, halachic, but updated, you know, not too much. What destroyed the model? There's a simple answer. Orthodoxy. Especially modern orthodoxy, but really orthodoxy generally, the success of orthodoxy. If the premise was, and this was the premise, that you can't adhere fully to halacha and become an active part of general society, well, that turned out to be false, because there are Orthodox Jews today roaming around the White House and Congress and the diplomatic corps and as lawyers and doctors and businessmen. So in fact, the non-Orthodox movements are a victim of our success. So what have they done? And this has really put the nail in their coffin. They shifted the focus from being purveyors, from being this sort of hybrid, adulterated form of Judaism to engage the modern world, and they became purveyors of Western values, meaning primarily purveyors of Western values. Egalitarianism, radical feminism, radical liberalism, pluralism, and that's become their focus. And once non-Orthodoxy became nothing more than a vehicle to disseminate those isms, they had an even more limited shelf life, and hence the rise of the unaffiliated, which never existed 40, 50 years ago. A Jew wanted to belong, but now if all my movements are telling me is that I have to be in the forefront of social justice, then why be part of it? I'll tell you a story. I won't mention his name, but you can figure it out. There was a former Speaker of the House I was sitting at breakfast with once. It was Jewish, and his family is very active in the conservative movement or the temple in his area. And he said to me at a certain point, you know, I stopped going there. I said, where do you daven now? He said, on Shabbos, when he's back home, he goes to Chabad. And I said, really? His wife was still going to the temple. I said, why Chabad? See, he said, it was Republicans. He said, I got tired every Shabbos of just hearing liberal values, liberal politics. I said, you want to go to shul, hear some Torah. So I know at least in Chabad I'll hear some Torah. But if the vehicle, if the movements became and have become just, as some cynics say, wings of the Democratic Party, but said in a different way, just disseminators of Western values, why didn't part of that movement? You could do it on your own as well. So now what's happened is they have, that's their main focus, and they use that focus, and they've embraced a certain tactic which probably drives a lot of us crazy. What do? At every opportunity, they foment controversy. And it's done just to stay alive, just to rile people up, just to keep the fundraising dollars flowing. It's always something. It's always involved in the Orthodox, either Orthodox bashing or Torah bashing, and we've lived this. And just go back years, the Orthodox don't consider us Jews. They don't recognize our converts. They don't recognize our rabbis. They don't recognize our marriages. They don't recognize our divorces. And now, most recently, they don't recognize our rights to the Kotel. Kotel, mandok ha-shmei. When do they ever have an interest in the Kotel? So we know already, 5 years, they have an area to daven without the mechitz at all. It's vacant. It's barren. But it's just an issue. I was once talking to many years ago to one of a non-Orthodox rabbi in the neighborhood, and I said to him, you know, what's he talking about, Rosh Hashanah? And he said about how the Orthodox don't accept our conversion. So I said to him, with all due respect, what in the world does that have to do with Rosh Hashanah? What does that have to do with Rosh Hashanah? Rosh Hashanah, tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah, shofar, kedis yitzhak, whatever it is. What does the fact that the Orthodox don't recognize your conversions have to do with Rosh Hashanah? And he said to me, this is the largest crowd of the year, all right? If I don't give them something that riles them up, that gives them a demon, they're not going to come back, they're not going to give money. Why join? So they need an enemy. We have become the enemy. And you see, most recently, in the American government's recognition of Yerushalayim as the capital of Israel after many years. So what was the reaction of the non-Orthodox movements? The Reform were against it before they were for it, and the Conservatives were for it before they were against it. Last week, a dozen rabbinical students at two conservative seminaries issued a statement condemning the decision as reckless and counterproductive and as one that offends Palestinian dignity. These are the conservative rabbis of the future, all right? I saw in the Wall Street Journal last week in a survey, 80% of evangelical Christians think that God gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people. 80%. Jews, 40%, and I think that's exaggerated, by the way. So the non-Orthodox seem to think, and again, I say this with sadness, that Israel can't survive without them. The fact is, even the recognition decision was propelled more by the evangelicals than by the Jews. And American support for Israel is rooted in Christian evangelicals much more than in Jews today, because Jews are unreliable friends of Israel today. But the fact is, Israel can survive quite well without them. Israel is prosperous and strong. The Reform need Israel more than Israel needs the Reform. They need it for ethnic solidarity. And only now, after the Kotel debacle, when they realized that they have zero traction in Israel, their cause, their movement, their ideology simply does not resonate with the Israeli public, even the secular one, they're waking up to that reality. Here's another reality that was like under the radar. Last month, the Reform movement lost the right to feed people to birthright. They were taken out of the mix because they were not meeting their quotas. Each organization had to provide a certain number per year, and they were falling short. Who's at the top of the list? Chabad, the OU. And even, they're obviously getting many Jews who are not religious in any sense, but they have little interest in joining a Reform or conservative structure. So they're being chopped. They're being chopped by what they see as authentic. And I think the key problem that they have, which is one they never really try to understand, is their inability to navigate our dual identity. Jews have a dual identity. We'll read in a couple weeks in the Torah. God says to us, God says to Moshe, V'lokachti eschem li le'om, v'yisi lachem le'elokim. You will be for me a people, and I will be for you a God. Meaning, we are, as Rav Hirsch said, a religio nation. We're not just a religion, we're not just a nation. We're not one or the other, we're both. We're an Am and a Das. They don't get that. Someone sent me a clip last week of a woman who was speaking. The context doesn't really matter, but her question, actually it wasn't a question, a lot of times people just, you know, talk. And she said, I'm Jewish, and the great thing about being Jewish is that you can believe or not believe. You can do as much as you want, as little as you want, and no one can ever take away your Jewishness. And she's absolutely correct. As an ethnic identity, as part of an Am, if all you see is that you're part of an Am, then you're correct. You can be a good Italian and not eat pizza or pasta. And you could be a good Frenchman and not drink wine, all right? But the fact is, Jewish identity has much more to it than ethnic attachment, to which it has Taryag Mitzvos, as a Torah, as a land of Israel. It has all the indicia of a nation and a religion of as well. We have a system of laws, of obligations. We have mitzvos. Part of those mitzvos are edios. All they see is the Am, halavai, they should only see that, but they don't see the Das. I'll mention, incidentally, there are fringe Orthodox groups that only see the Das and don't see an Am. Or they see an Am, 12 people, 100 people, no more. But we're both a religio nation. An Am with all the trappings of nationhood, and a Das with everything that means as well. So, if they're in a free fall, if everything is so bleak, why do I say there's a future for non-Orthodoxy? And here, Rabbi Shulman alluded to the answer. It's because we've all seen this before. It's always existed. And he referenced Korach in the Midbar. And keep in mind, Korach's argument was about Tarshe Baal Peh, was about Moshe's interpretation of the Tarshe Baal Peh, and he claimed that Moshe bada milibo. He was making it up as he went along. That was the first attack on the Tarshe Baal Peh. Even in the first Beis HaMikdash era, Shabbos and Mikdash coexisted, uneasily, but coexisted with rampant Avodah Zarah. In the second Beis HaMikdash, we face the Hellenists. And then the Tzedukim, their successors, who denied the Tarshe Baal Peh and challenged the Prushim and even dominated for a long time, almost two centuries, which is a little less than a little more than America, but at least the Tzedukim accepted Torah Min HaShamayim, that the divine origin of Torah. You can't say it anymore today. They disappeared with the Churban, as did the Essenes. And we had to deal with the early Christians and the early Muslims and the Karaites. There are always Jews who try to bridge the differences with Christianity and Islam and were later swept away by them. We had to deal with the Enlightenment, which really was just a prelude to the Reform and Conservatism of modern times. So non-Orthodoxy has always existed. We're not happy about it, but I'll say this. It does serve as a counterweight. It keeps us sharp. We continue to ponder the Torah, to think, to deliberate, to apply it to new circumstances and climates, to preserve the Mesorah, to internalize the Torah's teachings. So in fact, we wouldn't write the script that way, but there is a benefit in having ideas that distort the Torah to clarify for ourselves and our children and grandchildren what's the orthodox, what's the correct belief. What is it that we're supposed to be thinking and professing to the greater world? Said a different way, maybe in a halachic sense, there's a yetzer hara for maisim, for deeds, for averos. Our inclination, we have an instinct to do things that are improper, that we have to combat. But we have a yetzer hara for machshavos and hashkafos as well. And that's always the challenge of every generation. We're always tempted by the world. Yetzer hara exists in two contexts. One is in terms of masim, deeds, and the other is in terms of machshavos. Non-Orthodoxy basically represents the articulation of the Yetzer Hara in terms of machshavos, where they let the values of the world infiltrate and then dominate Jewish life. The critical question that they deal with, that we deal with as well, is one that has been challenging us since Avram's time. And that's what they tried to do. How do we interface? And to what extent do we interact with the modern world? So Avraham Avinu, as Rav Soloveitchik said, set the paradigm for us. Ger v'soshav anochi machem. Avraham said to the Bnei Ches, I'm both a stranger and a resident among you. That's an inherent contradiction? No. Avraham said, at my core, I'm a ger, because you're pagans of the Avodah Zarah. Your values are different. Depraved, etc. I'm sure he put it in a nicer way. I'm a ger. I don't feel at home with the value system, but I'm also a toshav in terms of society, in terms of science, in terms of medicine, in terms of the common wheel. I'm part of you also. So on one hand, we're gerim. On the other hand, we're toshavim. And every generation of Jews has to deal with this on some level, as Yeshua did, Yeshua ben Nun, as Shlomo HaMelech did in the first and second Batei Mikdash, in Bavel, with Yavon, with Rome, in Spain with the Rambam, in medieval France with Rabbeinu Tam, in Renaissance Italy, German Jews of the 18th and 19th centuries, Eastern European Jews of the 19th and 20th centuries, in America and Israel today. We're always trying to navigate that very treacherous road, which we don't veer too much to either side and be too much of a ger or too much of a toshav. We have to find the right balance, that we're faithful to ourselves, to our Torah, to our God, and yet also contribute actively to the rest of society. There will always be a competing value system in the world. And there will always be Jews who see those values as drawn from the Torah, or attributable to the Torah, or coexisting with the Torah, or in the worst case scenario, Rahman al-Islam, as superior to the Torah. And you have all those expressions today. Rav Huttner once asked a beautiful question. On Hanukkah, we had this phenomenon of the Misyavnim, of the Hellenists, all right? Why in the previous exiles, why were there never Misbavlim or Misashrim? We had Hellenists, why not Babylonists? Why not Assyrists? Why weren't we drawn to those cultures like the Jews were drawn to Hellenism? And of course, the Hashmonaim were a minority of the Jewish society. All right? The Jewish society minority. Most were Hellenists. Most fought against the Hashmonaim and sided with the Syrians. Of course, even with Bavel, with Ashur, here and there, Jews succumbed. But they were considered outliers. Rav Huttner said Greek culture was different. It was considered a very refined system of thought and expression, and even aspired to values, and even recognized higher powers in its own way. And think of what they contributed. Homer and Plato and Aristotle and Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides and Aristophanes and Herodotus and Thucydides. Names that give me nightmares because I had to read it in college and try to forget it. But some of these people, like Homer, go back to the first Beis HaMikdash era. And all of them long before the story of Hanukkah. Rav Huttner said it was Zeh Luma Zeh. They were equal, so Jews were drawn to it. The fact is, today, we have very similar dynamic before us. Western values are considered Hellenistic in its own way. I mean, the truth is, Western values are an outgrowth of Hellenism. They're considered moral. They're considered not pagan, superior. They're considered just, rational. So why then wouldn't a person follow that? Hellenism was sophisticated and attractive, and so Jews were drawn to it, but it was also morally corrupt. It exalted the material, the sensual, the physical, the body. So it was Tomei. And the victory of Hanukkah was Tomeim Beyat Tahorim. The pure defeated the impure. Today, by the way, you can't even say impure anymore. It's considered offensive to say some ideas. Tomei, who could say such a thing? Be written out of polite society. And yet, we have that dichotomy. We have Tahorim, we have Tomeim. There are always such Jews. There are always such confrontations. And it's the same today. So I spoke about non-orthodoxy, not to offend too many people, but if you look at what's loosely called the open orthodox, what I call the neoconservatives, they're repeating the mistake of the conservatives of the last century. And indeed, in many parts of modern orthodoxy today, there's too much emphasis on the modern and not enough emphasis on the orthodox, and it shows. The organizations that have been created that celebrate sin and heresy and Western, not Jewish values, that just stick Orthodox in their title, and they think they've achieved something. I understand why, as Rabbi Shulman mentioned, Orthodoxy, with all our problems, is the only form of Judaism that's prospering today. But you can't just call yourself Orthodox and then do and act and think and advocate, live as you please. An association of Orthodox Ganovim doesn't render theft permissible. Don't even think of starting one. It exists already. There are too many Jews today for whom being modern in the sense of adopting Western values and mores is their lodestar. Any facet of orthodoxy that doesn't comply must be blurred or eradicated or reformed. So in their circles, even Talmud Torah has become the search for the one opinion somewhere in Jewish literature that will permit me to do whatever it is I want to do. And they'll find, the Rishon here said this, that if interpreted, you know, in the dark, looking at it that way, maybe we could do what we want to do because that's the way it's said. And for those who think that Chulos can't be manipulated or distorted, read, or don't read, the work of Charles Freehoff, who's a very prominent Reform rabbi, wrote a whole book of reform responses, citing every Talmud, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, etc., all to just what they're doing. And he says, he openly says, this we don't accept, and we'll do what we want. But nonetheless, he had a very sophisticated understanding of the sources. Read some of the response from JTS, you'll find the exact same thing. Just because someone said something or wrote something does not necessarily mean it's applicable to any situation today. And of course, we're living in times in which basic moral norms have been upended. Someone once asked the great Chief Rabbi, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, that we say, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So if that's the case, how did your son Chaim stray so far? There are Jews who ask these questions to people directly. And Rav Herzog answered very cleverly, very insightfully, that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree when there's a ruach mitzuyah blowing, when there's a normal, gentle wind. But when there's a ruach she'eino mitzuyah blowing, when there's a wind that's abnormal and gusty, then the apple can fall very far from the tree. There is today a ruach she'eino mitzuyah blowing. There's a wind whose currents are uncontrollable, that gusts through our homes, that dominates our discourse, and even our values, that's trumpeted by the media. There's absolutely no way to stop its entry or its influence unless we take countermeasures. Every generation is given the tools to sort through these challenges and craft a response, and it's never a smooth process. And I tell you, those who think that there's only one way have not paid attention to Jewish history. The way of the Rambam was not the way of the Ramah, was not the way of the Vilna Gaon, nor Rav Hirsch, or the Ben Ish Chai, Rav Kook, Rav Soloveitchik. There are many different ways. Well, to summarize it, I would say that non-Orthodoxy has a future. As for the non-Orthodox, that's still unclear. We're losing many, many Jews. So the question is, and our task is, how do we ensure that non-Orthodox Jews have a future and just do not simply disappear? It's not, you know, someone estimated not long ago, and the number is really frightening, that in the last century, how many Jews have we lost in America to assimilation? 6 million. Think of the figure. 6 million. It's not entirely in our hands, but there's much that we can do. Obviously, at the very foundation is always to project and feel love to them, to embody goodness and kindness, to remain faithful to halacha, to feel sad when necessary, but never angry. Anger is never good. And above all, to be sincere. We have to reflect sincerity. We have to reflect integrity. We have to give people a reason to want to open themselves to Torah when they have not been taught it. It's so interesting. So many Jews outside our world think Orthodoxy is monolithic, that we all look and think and act the same. And of course, there's a great symmetry in terms of halacha, but in terms of hashkafa, there's much more leeway. And there's really no one right way. One, it's been in the news recently, can abandon rigid chassidus and still be a shomer mitzvos. The Eidora Mizrach are not all the same, even though we Ashkenazim all lump them together. It's just not so. They have not only different minhagim and tefillah, they have different poskim as well. Tell them to do different things. It's not all the same. Moroccans are not Yemenites, are not Syrians. It's just not so. Torah says, Veitzachayim Besoch Hagan, that in Gan Eden, Veitzachayim, the tree of life, which is really Torah, is Besoch Hagan. What's Besoch Hagan? It's right in the middle. So it's accessible from different angles. And this is a point that's made even clearer at the very end of Maseches Tainis. The Gemara says, Asad HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lasos Machol HaTzadikim. God in the future will make a circle, dancing circle, yeshiva shuffle, walk around in the circle for the righteous. We are shaved b'neim b'Gan Eden. God is sitting in the middle in Gan Eden. V'chol echad v'echad mar'e be'etzba'o. And each tzaddik points to Kavyachol HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right in the middle. What's the point? The point the Gemara is making is that each tzaddik is different. And each tzaddik may think that he has the right way to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But they're all in the circle. And in a circle, everyone is equidistant from the center. So they're all marabetz bo, inel kenu ze, they all do it. We're not all the same. But as long as we're faithful to Torah, we're all in the circle. And that's a beautiful pshat I heard once from Rav Aviner. He says, Shivim panim l'Torah. The Torah has 70 facets. We shouldn't think it has only one or two. It has 70 facets. But the fact that it has 70 means it doesn't have 71. That's already chutz l'machne. It doesn't have 75 or 100 or 120, 150. It has 70. We have to know what's within the Torah, what are the panim l'Torah, and what's outside the panim l'Torah as well. And one more point we should realize, and this is so important, so many Jews are searchers. And I've always thought that's why Jews are always in the forefront of movements across the world, social movements, political movements. We're always searching for the good. The Jews today, by the hundreds of thousands who are searching for the truth of Torah, even if they don't always know where to find it. So many Jews are involved in so many causes because the Jewish neshama always seeks truth. There's a thirst for it that we have to try to quench. So I'll tell you a story. Every week I try to read an Israeli weekly, B'Sheva. Get it online now. There's a columnist named Yedidya Meir. His wife's very popular now, Sivan Rav Meir, very popular teacher of Torah. He wrote last month about a Shabbat lunch he had in Yerushalayim in a Chabad home where a Chabad shalich and his wife had brought a group of unaffiliated Jews from their home. I looked it up. He's in Markham, Ontario, which is outside of Toronto. He brought all these Jews, first went to Poland, including Auschwitz. Then they went to Israel for Shabbos. They came, Shabbos lunch. And as happens, I've been on these groups as well. Everyone is asked to share their impressions. And these Jews, blank slates, tabula rasa. Some sat at Shabbat lunch without even kippot on their heads. Everything was first impression. It's really the first involvement in some form of intensive Jewish life. And they're asked to share. And they're all good people. But good people without Torah. And these are their impressions. One woman said, I have the article in front of me. I'm just translating from the Hebrew. One woman said, until this day, I had no idea what our history was. All the suffering, all the ignominy, heard about it. All the persecution and the glory of modern Israel. I had no idea, no real idea of any of this. And now all I want to say is Am Yisrael Chai. The Jewish people live, and I want to be part of that. Another woman said that they landed at Ben-Gurion the day before Thursday night. They went to the hotel. Friday, when they walked to the Kotel, the Kotel had hundreds and hundreds of people davening there, Jews davening. And she saw where she came from and what she was raised with, and she saw all these Jews. And one thought came to her mind. We're all mishpacha. This is my family. We're all one family. She felt an overwhelming sense of kinship with everybody there. Another grew up in Ontario, went to public high school, was the only Jew there, suffered because of it. The taunts, the slings, the arrows of her classmates. So she would tell herself again and again, keep your chin up. Be proud. But she had no idea what she was proud of. That she was a Jew? Yes, but so what? And now she came on this trip, and now she has a reason why she can keep her chin up. Why she should raise her profile. Because she sees what we've accomplished as a people, despite the onslaught of our enemies. And then he quotes a Jew named Raymond. All right? And I've led many tours, you should know. And every group has a clown, a jokester. And Yedidya Meir writes, and he realized right away this guy was the jokester of the group. And he got up and said, I want you all to know, my wife and I We're planning going to the beach today. Forget the davening. Forget the meal. It's 80 degrees. It's November in Israel. Might as well just take a cab, go to the beach. And something told him not to. And he went to shul. I guess they went across the street to the great synagogue. And he saw something that surprised him. He saw Birchas Kohanim. And you know why they were doing it. He remembers a child coming to shul with his father. And it was a yontif phenomenon. Every chag, there was Birchas Kohanim. And now he heard the Kohanim say, Yivarech Hashem v'yishmerecha. And it touched him to his core. And he told the group, every week now, come Shabbat, I want to say that to my children and to my grandchildren. Yivarech Hashem v'yishmerecha. There's a thirst. We can satisfy that thirst. I have no illusions that we can satisfy for everyone, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. With non-Orthodox Jews, they're in crisis. Non-Orthodoxy will always exist in some form because we need it as a counterweight. But with the people, we have to save as many as we can because they're our brothers and sisters. They're Klal Yisrael. We lose anyone, there's a deficiency. There's a gap. There's a chisaron in our world. We have to try to save those whom we can. And then we'll merit the beautiful words of the Navi, Ve'amech kulam tzadikim le'olam yirshu aretz. They're a nation of entirely righteous people. They will inherit the land forever. Netzer mata'ai, ma'aseh yodai lispo'er, a branch of my planting. All Jews were God's handiwork in whom God will be glorified. That is our task now, to try to bring back as many Jews as we can, so together we can merit lahagdil Torah ulahadira and welcome Mashiach Tzidkenu b'mehera b'yameinu. Amen. I thank you all very much. I know there's a collation downstairs. If anybody wants to ask some questions, I'm happy to entertain some good questions. No questions. Perfect. Yes, sir.
I just want to know what you said earlier, let's say about the Holy Torah and all that. So, I mean, how do you view that? You said that there's a piece of war.
I think they're the neoconservatives. And they're making the same mistake that the conservative movement did 100 years ago. And they're just repeating it. So right now they're a fringe part of the Orthodox world. I think people realize what's going on. I still hope, everybody hopes they could shift gears. But I think they're going in a direction that's not going to suit them well, nor help Jews in the future. Yes, sir. Good questions, remember, good questions. Like that one. I missed that. Say it again.
Right.
They exist, right, right.
What about the Orthodox? Are they really so successful? I think because... No, are they? Let's look at... fact is, the vast majority of the non-Orthodox have not been attracted. Fact is, today now, in some of the old kids at risk, we've had that 40 years. I've never heard of that. 40 years ago, I was told that the Hasidic children never leave us. Now, it seems to be a problem there. So, and... this is the biggest problem of all. There's absolutely no self-criticism in the Orthodox community. And I mean,
what about this? We just heard. It's a very good point. The truth is, it's a different topic altogether, the future of Orthodoxy. But I'll just correct some things that you said. We have new organizations for kids at risk, all right? I would never say that it didn't exist when I was a child. I went to high school, Yeshiva High School. I'm not so sure how many kids remained from after Yeshiva High School. We just didn't use the terminology. I think part of it is that, you know, Yeshiva is so expensive today. You're spending over the course of a child's education $200,000-$300,000. So a child goes off the derech, everyone has bechira. You want to say, well, what did I get for the money? All right? After all these years, what happened? So we're much more invested in the process than in the past, but it always existed. You can't say it didn't exist. You can't say Hasidim never left the Hasidic world in the past. It also happened. It does happen. It's always going to happen. Again, that's been true since ancient times as well. We deal with it. If you ask me, and I've said this, and you know, because everything in the world is always a crisis, and never just a problem. Everything's a crisis in Orthodox life. I happen to think, personally, in my experience, there are fewer kids at risk today than there was when I was in high school. But don't tell that to anyone, because there's so many more organizations dealing with the problem. It was much more pronounced 40, 50 years ago. That's what I saw in my experience, and I live it now. There are kids. There are kids who go off the derech for good reasons, go off the derech for bad reasons. But your point about everyone should be Orthodox, we looked at our lives, it's true, but, and here's where we come back to our topic tonight. We don't really have a Kiruv movement in Teaneck, for example. All right? There is an organization that deals with it. They do a fine job, and they deal with the unaffiliated. Why don't they deal with the Reform Conservative? Because where it exists, they do not believe they need Kiruv. They think they're the same. You do this, I don't. I do this, you don't, and therefore we're all the same. When people don't think they need Kiruv, and they think their approach is as legitimate as any other approach, why would they want to change? They have what they want. I think, again, this is based on experience, many of them wake up when they realize they're not conveying that sentiment or value system to their children. And their children are falling in love with non-Jews. And they say, maybe there's something wrong. Maybe I could have done it differently. Maybe yes, maybe no. So that becomes an eye-opener for them. But nonetheless, where the movement is cohesive and people have a sense of belonging, I've been told this in Teaneck by people living there, they resent the notion they need Kiruv. All right, so in that sense, it becomes an obstacle to bring them back. Nonetheless, I could tell you again, based on experience, there are many, many Jews who've come back to Torah simply by observing the way Orthodox Jews live. And someone just told me this the other day, I heard. Someone became religious simply by looking out their window and seeing a religious family walking home from shul on Shabbos. And she said, I want that for myself. How do I get that? And they became religious as well. This is perfect? No. Are there problems? Of course there are problems. Moshe Rabbeinu had to deal with Korach, and Dasam Vira, Meraglim, Mapilim. So the world without problems is a world that awaits the Mashiach, and he'll have problems also dealing with the Jews, because everyone will say, no, it can't be this guy. He has to wear this hat, this yarmulke, this coat, this jacket, etc. So that's all in the future. But Dailat Tzar B'Shaita, we have our work to do. If we live proper lives, lives of integrity, lives of commitment, like I said, sincerity, people will see it, they'll notice, and they'll come back as well. One more question? No? Thank you again very much.